Scotland, westerly winds will remain strong and a cold feeling day with temperatures ranging from 6 to 8 Celsius. On Thursday, the rain and cloud eventually clear away from southern England, lingering into the southeast of England. Blustery showers and sunny spells will prevail across the northwest corner of the UK, and in between, it'll be mainly dry and bright with some sunny spells remaining cool and breezy.
Stav Danaos, thank you. Now on BBC Radio 4, our Book of the Week. Toby Jones reads another extract from Philip Ziegler's new biography of Laurence Olivier. The newlywed Olivier is about to see his career take off.
From the moment he met him, Noel Coward found Olivier wildly attractive. He made it clear when he cast him in what would be a breakthrough part, a supporting role in Private Lives, that he would like their relationship to be physical as well as friendly. Olivier always felt slightly guilty that he did not respond. The idea, however, both repelled and alarmed him. He rejected the overtures, and Coward bore him no grudge. When Private Lives opened in August 1930, it proved to be an immense success. When his friend John Mills saw the play, Coward asked him what he thought of Olivier's performance. "Well," said Mills, "I couldn't believe that anyone that good-looking could be such a rivetingly good actor." "I'll tell you something," replied Coward. "In my much sought-after opinion, that young man will before long be acknowledged as our greatest actor." Successful or not, Olivier did not enjoy the play. Some years later, he admitted that he had been eaten with jealousy, that he was a second fiddle, not one of the leading players. Nonetheless, he went with Coward when the play transferred to New York, along with his new wife, Jill Esmond. She was anxious to move on to Hollywood after the run, where she knew profitable work awaited. Olivier was doubtful. He felt cinema was an inferior art form, and was also conscious he had not mastered the art of acting to camera, so was reluctant to expose himself to failure. In the end, he decided to give it a go. Coward was disdainful of their plan. "You've got no artistic integrity. That's your trouble. Hollywood." The reality was even worse than Olivier had envisaged. "He has no chance," said a studio executive. "His face is too strong and his looks are too rugged. When it comes to rugged actors, we don't need Englishmen." Worse, he acted as he did on stage, all broad gestures and a face forever busy with expressions. After 3 years, with only 3 second-rate films to his credit, but a reasonable cache of dollars in the bank, he decided to return to London. He and Jill moved into a house on Chelsea Embankment and prepared to entertain the cream of Bohemian London. But the dollars were soon running out, and though Olivier was offered one or two interesting parts, the financial rewards were not high enough to support the lifestyle to which he had become accustomed in America. Like it or not, he had to return to films. It is curious how long it took Olivier, an actor who would repeatedly show himself as an innovator, to realise that the cinema made demands on a performer quite different from those posed by the stage. In part, this was because he continued to despise the medium. "There's something rather terrible and cold-blooded about acting in a film studio," he told his sister. "Films can help you buy your wife a house in the country, but I still don't believe they can help you to act." Even when he had become a major film star, he never seemed altogether at home on screen. Orson Welles said that Olivier was the master of technique. "And yet, as fine as he has been in films, he's never been more than a shadow of that electric presence which commands the stage. Why does the cinema seem to diminish him?" In July 1933, he went back to Los Angeles to play the Spanish lover in Garbo's Queen Christina. At this time, she was the best-known film star in the world, and Olivier was more than ready to take the role. He had reckoned without his co-star's idiosyncrasy. She seemed not so much to dislike him as to be unaware he was there.
Soon the producer told him he was no longer required. At the time, it was a humiliating rebuff, but perhaps it was a good thing. If he had acted opposite Garbo and achieved success and fortune, we might never have seen his Henry V, his Richard III, his James Tyrone. And the history of the National Theatre might have been very different. If one had to pick out three or four plays that defined the development of Olivier's career, the first would certainly be The Green Bay Tree, a dark drama about a homosexual relationship. It shocked and astonished its audiences. Olivier disliked the part, but recognised the opportunity it gave him, and was memorable for him because it was directed by Jed Harris, who could be a cruel little bastard, but had a theatrical brain of rare excellence. He left an enduring mark. He gave Olivier a sense of discipline and seriousness about the theatre, forcing him to introduce new depths into his acting to a degree that he had not so far achieved. He was sensational, remembered Noel Coward. It was a marvellous, extraordinary performance. Olivier's next play won him his first popular following. He was engaged by Coward to play the swashbuckling hero of Theatre Royal. He flung himself into it with reckless zest. His first entry involved a spectacular leap on the stage from the top of a steep staircase. There was no need for this, but Olivier was determined to impose himself on the audience from the outset. John Gielgud was one of the many who admired Theatre Royal, and Olivier was similarly ready to acknowledge the greatness of Gielgud. He was transfixed by his Richard II, by the grace of it, by the insight that flowed from its understated eloquence. But the consciousness of rivalry was always there. "Larry was always jealous of me," Gielgud remarked dryly. The contrast between the two men was striking. Olivier was power, passion, and animal magnetism. Gielgud, precise, exquisite, melodious. "It was the difference between nature and art," Kenneth Tynan suggested. Gielgud was better established on the London stage, and soon to try his hand as an actor-manager. Olivier had stolen a march in film. He would have been extraordinarily grateful if he had known that James Agate, the leading critic of the day, when asked the contemporary equivalents of the Irvings and Ellen Terry, answered that they were Gielgud and Edith Evans, with a reservation in favour of Laurence Olivier as the most promising young actor. Gielgud now propelled his rival into the next stage of his career. He conceived the idea of producing Romeo and Juliet, alternating the roles of Romeo and Mercutio with another actor. At first, Olivier refused, as he planned to put on the play himself with his wife Jill Esmond as Juliet. But he changed his mind when he heard Gielgud had signed Peggy Ashcroft for the part, with Edith Evans as the nurse. It was generous of Gielgud to offer this to Olivier. It may have been that he felt he could outshine the young pretender. Up to a point, he was proved right. Olivier was the first to play Romeo, and he was savaged by many of the critics for his inability to speak poetry. "His blank verse is the blankest I've ever heard," said the Sunday Times. Olivier was appalled. His intention was, and always would be, to speak the verse as if that is the way you speak naturally. His immediate offer to resign was refused. But not all the critics condemned his approach. The Observer said the critic had seen few sights so moving as the spectacle of Mr. Olivier's Romeo. "Larry was the definitive Romeo," Peggy Ashcroft said. "A real, vigorous, impulsive youth." Alec Guinness, a relatively junior member of the cast, was less generous. "He seemed a bit cheap and vulgar, making nonsense of the verse." But Olivier's way was the future. Over the years, he much improved his delivery of verse, but he never yielded his belief that the sense of the line came first, that it was speech. Gielgud himself was to modify his style as a result. He summed it up thus. I spoke the poetry much better, but Larry got the girl. Gielgud was more put out by Olivier's rendering of Mercutio than he had been by his Romeo. He complained about the loudness and extravagant tricks of Olivier's performance, and speculated that the critics would treat it harshly. Possibly he feared that a too conspicuous Mercutio might distract the audience from his Romeo. The audience response did not suggest any problem. Romeo and Juliet, with the two friends alternating roles, ran for 6 months and were still playing to full houses when the show had to close. In the middle of July 1936, filming was to start on Alexander Korda's new patriotic epic, Fire Over England. In it, Olivier played a heroic sailor who almost single-handedly defeated a dastardly Spanish plot to assassinate Queen Elizabeth. The reviews were not ecstatic, but his performance brought him no discredit. It had, however, more lasting consequences. Opposite him, playing the object of his passionate devotion, was a young actress called Vivian Leigh. When they began working on the film, Vivian remarked how glad she was that they were going to act together. "We shall probably end up by fighting," prophesied Olivier. "People always get sick of each other when making a film." His words were soon proved spectacularly untrue. They had not met for the first time on the set. Vivian had first seen him in Theatre Royal. "That's the man I'm going to marry," she is said to have announced. She was a rising actress who had made her name the previous year in the film The Mask of Virtue and was now at least as celebrated as Olivier in the world of cinema. She was unequivocally, triumphantly beautiful. She was also clever, funny, and when she wanted to be, exceptionally charming. She was no more intellectual than Olivier, but could give the impression of deep culture. She was also manipulative, cunning, and determined, and what she wanted she almost always got. She wanted Laurence Olivier. Her nice barrister husband, Lee Holman, was irrelevant in this. She had married him for the sake of security and would abandon him without a qualm. Alexander Knox, who had a small part in the Korda film, said that during filming it was almost immediately obvious to everyone that the pair were in love. The intensity of their affair was noticeable in all their scenes together. By the time the film was finished, Olivier's marriage was, to all intents and purposes, at an end. But it was a long time before that would become evident to the rest of the world. In the meantime, he had a career to advance. Swashbuckling roles in silly films might serve well to earn some money, but his performance in Romeo and Juliet had convinced him that what he wanted most of all was to make his future in classical plays on the London stage. This meant, above all, Shakespeare, and Shakespeare meant the Old Vic. Under the leadership of Lillian Bayliss, this scruffy, shabby theatre, unfashionably south of the Thames, had become the Shakespearean centre for the country, indeed, the world. "I was always determined to be a sort of top actor," Olivier said much later. "I knew that if you continued to not quite bring off the classics, you were never going to make it." To reassure himself he was doing the right thing, he rang up his friend Ralph Richardson, who was acting in New York. "Shall I go to the Old Vic?"
"It gets a very good idea," came the terse reply. It was done.
Toby Jones was reading extracts from Olivier by Philip Ziegler. The book is abridged and directed by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Where we'll have the shipping bulletin for you in a couple of minutes. sailing by. Another shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday the 6th of November. There are warnings of gales in Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Seoul, Lundy, Fastnet, Shannon and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Developing low, moving steadily northeast, expected Wales 993 by 1800 Wednesday. Low German Bight 986, moving steadily eastwards and losing its identity by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking north at Cira, south at Cira, southwesterly, backing southerly for a time, 4 or 5, showers good. Forties, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger, west 5 or 6, rain or shower.